Hello and welcome again to the NLORM podcast series. I'm Stan Crook. I'm chairman and CEO of NLORM, and I'm your host for the NLORM podcast series. This podcast series focuses exclusively on the needs of the NanoRare patient and NanoRare families. And we are extremely proud and privileged to be serving the NanoRare community. And today we have as our special guest, Olivia Kim McManus, who is a clinical associate professor at UCSD and is one of our treating physicians. Olivia, welcome.
Thanks so much, Stan. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and just yesterday, Olivia and our patient and mother went through our patients that she's taking care of, Olivia's taking care of, second dose, and it went really well. And so we're all very pleased about that. I got a video from the hospital room from our patient's mom. Thanks for taking such good care of him.
No, it's my pleasure. It's such an important opportunity to be able to do things like this for our patients.
Yeah. So Olivia, I know you went to UCI and you've gone on after doing pediatric residency in neurology. Your primary focus, I think, is in epilepsy, or at least certainly one of your areas of interest. Is that right?
Right. I was at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and then I did epilepsy and neurophysiology in Irvine, and then I've been down as faculty neurosciences at UCSD, and I'm at Rady Children's pediatric neurology.
When you started medical school, did you realize that you were going to be taking care of little kids with neurological diseases? Was that something you always wanted to do?
Actually, it does stem back to undergrad years when I was in New York City at Columbia, and that was my major was neurosciences to begin with, and then in medical school at Children's National, GW, I was very fortunate to work with a lot of neurologists there, and pediatric neurology really became my mainstay from there. Yeah.
Well, there are plenty of severe neurological diseases that need all the good hands and good people that we can find, that's for sure. And so then, when did you become more interested in the electrical aspects of the central nervous system, epilepsy and the like?
Yeah, I mean, when we are, epilepsy is one of the most common conditions of childhood neurology, neurological disorders, and there's so many different etiologies as to why somebody can have a seizure. Many times when it's really refractory, medically refractory, meaning your seizures are not controlled with two or more medications, that is often due to an underlying genetic etiology or cause. And so that kind of, directed my efforts in that direction, because so many kids who have really uncontrolled seizures do have a genetic underlying if diagnosed, and those who aren't diagnosed deserve that opportunity too. So that's kind of the direction I went in, because I specialize in caring for the children who either need specialized therapies due to underlying genetic causes or some sort of surgical intervention. But there's such a great need, and so many different underlying causes that we are aware of and coming out more and more, through diagnosis.
You bet. Of course, we see epilepsy in our CNS patients almost universally, right? Oh. And of course, the patient you're taking care of has one of the more common causes of genetic epilepsy, a mutation in an ion channel. Maybe we could talk a bit about ion channels and what they do and why they play such a prominent role in epilepsy.
Yes. I mean, ion channels, if you think of epilepsy, and epilepsy means you've either had two or more unprovoked seizures or epilepsy syndrome associated with seizure and recurrence risk of seizures. And if you think of homeostasis in the brain, anything that can disrupt homeostasis, and a lot of that is going to be neuronal communication with ions. So if you have disruption in a normal ion opening or closing, that's going to impair cell communication. And that's the underlying problem with seizures, is that there's abnormal synchrony of cells And that's due to a lot of times due to this irregular homeostasis, and ion channels are one aspect.
What fraction do you think of the epilepsy that comes your way is sort of the common garden variety that gets more severe? What fraction of that do you think is genetically caused?
I would say, at least 20 to 30% are going to be refractory due to medications. And so that can be a lot of underlying. I think that even kids or patients who we don't necessarily think are genetic actually are, and that's why we need to continue testing. I'm sure that it's more than what we actually know.
Yeah, I'm very confident that there is some modest genetic problems come in all flavors, right? And
right.
So even in the standard run epilepsy, I think there are a lot of times there's a genetic factor that we have no idea about. So I'm sure, yeah. I certainly agree with you.
And many of these, it's not just manifestation with epilepsy with these pediatric genetic disorders, is that there's so many other organ systems that are affected. And that is why treatments like ASO, which are more targeting the underlying pathology, could affect multi-organs. You know, there's different opportunities for targeted intervention beyond just the brain.
Well, and you know, I think we have now, you and I have quite a little bit of history over the last little bit trying to get our patient treated.
Mm-hmm.
I think something that folks would be very interested in is why you have many, many choices of how you invest your time, but you have far less time than you have choices, right? Why invest so much time and energy as we've had to in getting this patient treated and getting, you know, Rady and UCSD positioned to take care of these nanorare patients?
Mm-hmm. This is a really important opportunity to bring forward new therapies or potential therapies for all these patients where there is none. And so especially every patient deserves that opportunity. And, you know, the nanorare ones don't really have commercial opportunity because they're so few and far in between. There's no real possibility for that to happen on a macro level. And that's why we need to, as neurologists and, caregivers on many levels, provide opportunity for every patient. And it's going to be an opportunity to optimize medical care, because a lot of it is currently symptomatic management without really getting at the underlying. And that really is, as we have more and more genetic diagnoses, it's an important aspect that we really should go forward to see how much of the landscape can we change. There's clear opportunity physiologically that makes sense, and we need to try to bring it forward for these patients of ours.
And I'm sure you would agree that as we learn about one mutation and one ion channel and one patient, that we're learning lessons that are going to apply across the board to ion channels, to neurological disease, and to disease in general.
That's exactly right, because we, you know better than anyone else that there's so many different potential ion pathologies, you know, so that is, again, ways that we can potentially intervene if we know that that's a dysfunctional channel.
And, you know, we have quite a number of patients with mutations in the very ion channel that your patient has, and their symptoms vary fairly widely, even though their mutations are similar and in the same gene. And once again, I think that's something important that we need to learn. And, you know, we're going to be watching, you know, your patient here in the next little bit and see what sort of reversal or change in the pattern of epilepsy takes place, right?
Right.
And it really will beg the question, you know, later, if it's how much intervention can we do at reversibility, and then, you know, how far back can we go, and then can we intervene? What's the earliest intervention that can be possible before symptom presentation? You know, really, it would be ideal for these kids when they're babies.
Well, one of the questions that I really am looking forward to, getting some partial answers to at least, and be interested in your thoughts, is how much of the developmental delay that you see in most of these kids that have epilepsy do you think is due to just the after effects of multiple epileptic seizures versus, the underlying mutation that's driving everything else? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make because, yes, both it will manifest both with developmental delay, the mutation itself, with seizures too. But the seizures, in and of itself, of course, if they're really uncontrolled, have their own impact on top of the genetic predisposition. And so it really needs to be addressing both things and, you know, good seizure control as much as you can with available therapies while we're moving forward with other potential more targeted treatments. But those are both going to be impacting development together.
It sort of reminds me of the early days of treating diabetes, not so early, a decade ago or so. The big fights have been going on for decades. Are we going to fix everything if we manage glucose, right? And so I think we have sort of similar questions here. You attended our first colloquium. And we were very pleased for you to do that, and thank you so much for that. And you participated in the patient panel. I wonder what you expected out of before you went, and then how you felt that meeting went, and what you took away from it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to going again this year. That was a very, very unique colloquium that brought together different aspects of, you know, all the efforts towards nanorare disease and therapeutics. And it was unusual to have academia, physicians, parent pa and patient advocates, and then industry, you know, supporters as well, and just so many different aspects coming together in that forum uniquely, and just bringing the perspectives just towards the same goal. It's not often that you see it like that, and so I've seen follow-up iterations across the board, and that's great because we're just continuing to increase visibility and for the need and the ongoing efforts. So it's just fabulous that you put that together and brought so many different entities together. And I think that's the way forward for supporting nanorare diseases and potential therapeutics, because you really need collaboration across so many different entities. It requires institutional support, you know, and funding mechanisms, and it's the parent voice and parent advocacy voice is so important as well. And then it's ongoing also in terms of regulatory, even, you know, with FDA, because this is all kind of evolving for nanorare drugs, INDs. And so it was an important opportunity, and I think it's going to be really exciting to see it again this year, especially as the more cases have been coming forward too.
Oh yeah, I think by the end of the year we'll be in the 20s, maybe even as close to maybe 25, 28 patients that we will have treated, and that wealth of experience and information is going to be just wonderful to share. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And Biogen hosted it in their facility last year. This year, Biogen has developed a relationship with the Marriott next door, so we're going to have a much bigger space.
Oh,
And
nice.
I think that because I think we're going to have a lot more people too, and we want to accommodate everyone who wants to come. And so far, everybody we asked has said yes. So that's great. We're looking forward to seeing you there. That's for
I'm
sure.
sure it's going to get bigger and bigger every year.
And you were on the physician panel. Anything stand out, from your participation with the other folks on that panel that you think would be worth emphasizing to the folks who are listening?
Yes, I love all the physicians who are also on the panel too, and they are, it's really nice to connect with people who have been doing it and also kind of sharing the experiences in our own institutions and bringing it forward. And it is different, with a little bit in terms of the number of patients, whether it's one or a few, but still so much similarity there. And so it's really important to have that kind of network because it's so new, and I continue to have collaborations. It was really an important opportunity to be able to speak along with them.
Yeah. And I think you used the keyword network. That's the way I think of what we're doing is we're creating this network of treating institutions and physicians and research investigators coupled to NLORM as a means to treat and to learn. And I think there was just so much learning that came out of that meeting. And certainly I carried a lot back with me.
Yeah, exactly. Because the whole point is there's a lot of, it's all new. It's a challenge to create this within institutions because it's new too, and not just institutionally, but in different funding sources. It's just a different idea of N of one. And so to not be redundant and doing, the same struggles across different institutions, but kind of learning from each other and how expediting it for everybody is really the idea behind that network, I think. And that's why the colloquium and things like those forums are helpful and important so we can learn and share information.
And of course, we had our share of challenges in getting UCSD to commit to do this. And the reasons that it was difficult are the same reasons in every institution. And I think your perseverance in that effort is probably a really important lesson for everybody. I admire the fact that you stayed the course.
It was a struggle, but you know what? Put a challenge in front of me and I will push forward harder than anybody else. It's like it definitely requires a big team. So even though I was pushing here, there were so many people, even within administration and within the department that were supportive, but it is a new concept to bring forward an N of one. And then, there's not really a space that it falls under naturally to bring forward an investigator-initiated N of one clinical trial. Really, that doesn't fall under regular clinical trial category. It doesn't fall under, separate a lot of, so that's where it kind of was a challenge, but I think it definitely takes a village, even though, yeah, you definitely need to keep pushing forward. And I'm glad we're here at this point.
Me too. And I was thrilled that there was real interest at your institution with our patient and the first dose and all that. And hopefully, just the fact that we're doing this the first time will ease the way for the second, third, fourth, and nth.
Right. And it was really amazing. I was really appreciative because even for our second dose, which was on Wednesday and went home yesterday, our hospital leadership CEO and COO actually came by and checked in on our patient and said hello. So, the support is really there. And I think there's a lot of understanding and excitement towards the potential for ASO therapeutics. Even yesterday, our grand rounds was on ASO. So you see, there's a huge shift. It's just understanding it and bringing it forward. And we want to continue to push that edge for what is possible for our kids. It shouldn't be what's only now and baseline. It should be continuing to do reinvent the wheel as you have been doing.
Well, I think you made a really important step at UCSD. And was it Paul Taylor who gave grand rounds yesterday? So Paul Taylor, of course, is at St. Jude's, and St. Jude's is one of our collaborating institutions. And so I think the more that the various investigators and various institutions share with each other and their institutions, the better this is going to be.
Yes, exactly. And that's why, I mean, I also just submitted a manuscript along with a lot of other collaborators across the country, because exactly to that point, we just want to continue to share info and show everybody else how to move things forward in their own institutions too, if possible.
Yeah, I've spent the last few days trying to finalize the next draft of this manuscript on that first 173 patients we processed. I'm hopeful that we're getting close to getting it out. It's been a well, again, it's totally novel. No one knows what to
Right.
do with this, and so it's taken us a little while to get it out into a journal, but it's a top tier journal, and so I'm excited to be seeing
Yeah.
what happens these days.
No, it's going to be super exciting to see more and more papers coming out about this, you know, because it'll help expedite it for everybody, I think.
Well, it's wonderful to chat with you. Is there anything I haven't asked that I should have asked before we call it enough?
I don't know. I will just have to see. I don't have any specific things to add, but that I'm just excited that we are at this point of dosing for our patient. There's additional ones coming down the pipeline with other genetic variants. And, you know, I really look forward to helping my other patients who have ASOs, you know, pending through Enlorum as well. And, you know, whenever you're out here next, Stan, you better come and visit.
Okay, I'll do that. I promise. I promise. Okay.
I know you're going to be in Southern California next week.
you're not getting me to San Diego, though. I'm sorry, but next trip. How about that?
Okay, sounds good. Next trip.
Well, say hello to all my friends at UCSD,
I
and
will.
again, thanks so much for all that you've done, all that you're going to do, and thanks for this.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
Thank you all for being here. We're just really, really thrilled to have each of you. So I guess it would be great to start off with kind of hearing from you about your sort of journey to working with Enlorum and sort of what do you feel are the important things that we bring and that we need to make sure that we maintain in our relationship with working with you. And Alessia, if we might start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Well, first, I'd like to thank Stan for his vision and leadership. And I'd also like to acknowledge and thank both Dr. Stan and Dr. Roseanne Crook for putting the wind in the sails of the Enlorum initiative. So I think that's been terrific for all of us and especially for our patients. So as a baby doctor, I get to take care of children and families who don't get to choose me. They have to sort of accept that I'm on call that night. And consequently, I have to earn their trust. And that earning process has, for me, really informed how I then manage and help them manage their hope. Because they then rely on me, as do the UDN participants who get diagnosed, rely on those of us who participate in their diagnostic odyssey. They rely on me and us to help them hope. And so, in order for me to respect that hope, I need to be able to trust the processes, opportunities that I refer the patients to, and Enlorum is for me the sort of benchmark of trust. Enlorum has taken extraordinary measures to be sure that when a patient is referred, that patient receives absolutely transparent, rigorous, and informed by experience consideration. And I know that if the answer is yes, and Enlorum will take that patient will get extraordinary care and treatment from Enlorum. But I also know that if Enlorum decides that for whatever reason, because of the biology of the variant, because of the progression of the disease, or for other reasons that that patient is not a candidate for an ASO developed by Enlorum, that I can trust that opinion and work with that patient and family to move on to the next source of hope. So I think trust for me is a big deal for NLORM.
Yeah, thank you, Sesh. Liz, what about you?
So I want to thank Stan also for developing this program and all the people who work for the program, because we've had great relationships with them. But I think when I went into neurology a long time ago, I went into neurology because I felt like it was a completely open field where we didn't have really any treatments and any treatments targeted to the diseases that we actually treat. And I thought, well, there's going to be research, and I'm going to be there for the happening of those treatments. So I thought that was going to happen about 20 years ago. But now, after 30 years, it's actually happening. So this is extremely exciting. And over the years, I've kind of gotten to be known as the rare genetic disease doctor of neurology patients in Chicago. And so I get self-referred patients, and so my patients do often choose me, but unlike Sesh, or you know, doctors choose to send the patients to me. And I look at this and I've, okay, there's a gene mutation, and it's in a gene that I've never seen a patient before, because that's getting really common these days. And I immediately go and dig into the internet and papers and everywhere and try to find out, what does the protein do? What does the gene do? What's the mutation doing to the gene? And then I meet with the family and try to figure out, how big of an impact is this disease having on the family? And then I ask some questions. Are there trials for this disease? Often not, because there's only 50 patients in the world. Or is there a foundation? Sometimes there's a small foundation that a family has created online. What work is going on the disease? And then I ask, is this a mutation that could be targeted by an ASO? Because that really has been like one of my frontline questions when I see a patient in the past couple of years. And then one can go through a process of thinking through the types of mutations and even submitting to NLORN, which I have also done. So then even in the back of my mind, if I'm thinking, ooh, this is an intronic mutation, maybe it would be targetable by an ASO, I'm thinking, what is the disease concept model for this disease? What are the things that are impacting the family most about this disease? What would I want to try to improve on, and how would I measure that? And I think those are the things that go through your head as you see these patients. And the fact that we even have the opportunity to do that is frankly amazing. So really, every rare disease patient I'm looking at, I'm thinking, what could we actually do to treat this person's underlying biology? And I think by doing that, we have the opportunity in this generation to understand basic concepts like, what can we actually reverse if we treat patients after birth, you know, when they have neurological diseases? How much havoc has already been wreaked on the brain by the time you get to the patient at 5, at 6, at 30? Those are concepts that we need to learn, and we're only going to learn that by collecting all the information, sharing the information, working together, and then that will circle back and help us understand the clinical responses to these drugs is going to help us understand the disease mechanisms somewhat, you know, even the basic science disease mechanisms somewhat better, and it's going to help us understand how to do the whole process better and what measures can work to measure changes in what patients. And just being a part of that process is extremely exciting, and NLORM has certainly facilitated that.
That's awesome. Thanks, Liz. Olivia, what about you?
I mean, for me, as my perspective from a pediatric epileptologist, I mean, you can see the amazing families that were up here this morning. That's very representative of my clinic. It's different variants, but often manifesting with similar symptoms, which are very intractable and severe at onset. And so the fact that there is even a potential for a targeted treatment, this is very important, because it's not just about, you know, seizures and brain, but it affects the whole body in a genetic mutation. And so the opportunity to even provide patients with a targeted therapy, this is so important to even put out there that it's a possibility. And then that will also, you know, continue to drive earlier genetic diagnosis and interventions. This is very important and will change, I think, landscape of neurologic potential, you know, as mm-hmm. Liz mentioned already. And so this is why I'm working with NLORM and the amazing team that they have.
That's awesome. Neil, what about yourself?
Well, I think my relationship to NLORM is a little bit different than a lot of panelists and other doctors that work with this wonderful group. I'm an ALS guy. I don't work on many diseases. I work on a disease. You know, ALS is a devastating disorder still, and despite a lot of great work from a lot of people around the world over, you know, 80 plus years since Lou Gehrig had this disease, you know, we still have very little, you know, to offer our patients, except those rare patients who have genetic mutations, whom I think we can now offer a gene-based therapy. That is attacking the most proximal mechanisms in the development and genesis of the disease. I said I came to this out of my experience with FUS ALS, and you know, I can say I've been doing this, you know, for 25 years. It's the single most satisfying thing I've done is the work I've done with JC and Anna, Ionison and Lorem. And, you know, I just see the potential to do more of this for more patients with even more rare mutations than the FUS mutations. And Lorem provides, for the reasons you've heard, you know, today, you know, a platform to do it. You know, wonderful people that you've seen on stage, you know, that are trying to enact Stan's vision for this. And, you know, you heard the words hope, you know, rigor. And dedication. This is what we offer patients with, I think, a potential to help lots of people. And even though I'm a single disease guy, I think that the things that we're doing through Silence ALS and for ALS patients and families have large implications for other diseases as we hone our processes and our approach to these cases.
Awesome. Thanks, Neil. So I just wanted to have a couple questions about kind of the patient identification and sort of movement into NLORM, determining whether we can help these patients or not. And Sesh, maybe we could start with you. I know you spoke about your leadership in the UDN and what an important element that is to potentially be able to then the therapeutic matching committee that you lead. And I was just wondering if you could share a little bit with this group is about the considerations from even a technical or a functional genetics perspective that you're putting in your mind, and also as a member of the ATTC. So when you're thinking about these recommendations, this is such an important decision, and it's the gravity of the decision we fully acknowledge is significant for different patients. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that.
Yes, well, the Undiagnosed Diseases Network does focus on genomic diagnosis, but then functional confirmation and mechanistic confirmation of what is encoded by the specific variant that the patient carries. And so the UDN participants have an unusual leverage in that we understand something about how the misspelling in the gene disrupts the patient's body. And so that knowledge is critical as we think about who would be best served by which kind of therapeutic intervention. And having that kind of understanding really helps the Undiagnosed Diseases Network cooperate in a very open and transparent way with NLORM. In addition, the UDN does very deep clinical phenotyping. So we know what current status of each UDN participant is from a biomarker standpoint, from an imaging standpoint, from an operational standpoint for activities of daily living. And so we can share with NLORM what at least our opinion is about what amount of that phenotype is reversible and what amount of that phenotype is not going to be reversible. And that's so important in informing the thoughts about who is really going to benefit most from an ASO. It also is critically important to share with family members or the patient to be sure that they all understand that given this phenotype, this is at least one, this is what we can expect might be reversed by the ASO treatment.
Yeah, and that's a really, I think the point about the depth of the understanding that the UDN gains on these mutations is really important, because not all patients are being diagnosed through UDN, of course. And we know many of the patients that actually apply to NLORA may have a mutation that has some knowledge around the functional consequence, but if it's not sufficient information and sufficient research on that consequence, our team, we are not able to identify and feel confident in an ASO strategy. And that's definitely a component, that sort of proof of concept element, is how can we support, even from the diagnosis, to really and truly having an understanding of the functional consequence, so that then our team can get to work on what the ASO strategy might be. Olivia, I wonder if we could turn to you and just, you know, would love to get your perspective as kind of you continue to grow your practice and at Rady, and thinking about the patients that you would nominate for treatment with NLORA. From a clinical perspective, what are some of the things that you're thinking about or that you're looking for, that, you know, even building on what Liz said, is you know, how you're thinking at the very beginning about how you would be able to assess the benefit of a treatment or not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the basis is going to be the genetic testing is going to be the main thing first. And then in terms of clinical symptoms, you know, what is most bothersome to the patient? Also, what is the disease-specific clinical symptoms that we can potentially follow along a treatment regimen or a clinical trial and assess for change or interventional effect? Mm-hmm. Is very important to really streamline, because everybody is different. Every variant is... You know, as much variability as there is with genetic variants, there is with phenotype as well. And so it really has to be tailored to each individual. And also, it's not an easy process to even consider doing an ASO trial in your child. It's a big decision as well. And so that comes into play. And so those are some of the main features that really have to be addressed.
Yeah, thank you. That's very helpful. So I wanted to, in the next couple of questions, talk to Liz and Neil. So both of you have been treating patients with the ASOs, and just speaking to your experience, you know, in Liz, really thinking again, wanted to come back to the fact that you are the expert here on many of these outcomes, and I think this closet concept, that's so cool. We continue to hear about that, and from a neurodevelopmental perspective. And just really thinking about, from your perspective, what are some of the key kind of challenges that you have had, or things that you've been thinking about in the context of continuing to make your treatment decision, as far as understanding the benefit risk and whether this ASO seems to be helping a patient?
Well, you know, there's a whole list of things that goes into consideration. Obviously, you know, we can diagnose a patient with a super rare disease that's a degenerative disorder, but if they really have limited function left, then there may be no way for us to actually stop the disease, even if we had something that worked. So that's a consideration. A consideration is whether the family is ready to take a jump into experimental treatments. And, you know, then the consideration is, do they have something that we can actually target? And in terms of trying to get the whole thing together, if we decide we can treat a patient, there's really, these patients come from all over, and they often have clinical information here and there, and so you really have to try to gather. We've been fortunate with the patient that we've treated. We got all of his information from Boston very nicely. We've been able to coordinate with a neurologist in Florida for things like EEGs. We do have to coordinate our institution, actually, and we have a process that we developed for that, actually, through our Angelman syndrome work, where we, you know, when we admit patients who are getting ASOs after their first doses overnight, we have a whole system with the nursing services there, and, you know, you have multiple professionals that do things that just kind of work on our trials, like nerve conductions and MRI, and so there are really many things to consider and coordinate in an individual hospital. It is quite an undertaking, but worth it.
Yeah, and Neil, I mean, that's exactly, I feel like, a lot of your experience as well. I mean, of course, patients come from all over to see you at Columbia, and I wonder if you could just comment, you know, a little bit on how you envision that working from a coordinated care perspective and data collection, and even patients who are at other sites outside of New York City, perhaps, or even outside of the U.S., but still want to get this treatment and perhaps have the dose administered by you.
Yeah, so a lot of what we're doing with NLORA for silent ALS is informed by or based on our experience with the FUS ASO, where, you know, which began as an N of 1, and then 2, and then 5, and then 10. And, you know, I think this is going to be the experience of a lot of people. And then people come to you from, you know, many parts of the country and different countries, and you have to figure out a way of adapting your process to accommodate these people. And this is what we're doing and going to have to do more of with Ann Lorem. I think it's hard to standardize because institutions are so different and local specifics are different, but we're trying through silence and I think Ann Lorem more generally to standardize these things in a way that would make it easier to involve other patients, other genes, other mutations, and I think that's coming. And I just also I think wanted to say in terms of process that and Stan said it this morning that these are human experiments, right? So you're dealing with a lot of uncertainty, and you can be as careful as you want to be with in advance of delivering an ASO, with phenotyping and trying to predict phenotypes and endpoints, and but you have to be prepared to accept the unexpected. Stan presented the case of Anna today. Anna bottomed out. We thought that she was dying, and then began this absolutely remarkable, unprecedented functional recovery at a time when people had given up on her. She hadn't given up, and her family hadn't given up. So, we're learning what success looks like in these diseases where there's never been success. We're learning to. How to deal with patients at the time of nomination until through the period of ASO development and delivery, and then through the treatment period. So these are very early days, I think, and I just think we have a lot to learn.
We do have a lot to learn. And, I think even the standardization, the red cap that Lori spoke about earlier, in theory, the idea would be that the same red cap CRFs could be leveraged for any physician. So, for example, if Liz's patient is being seen in Florida and, all these other places, then anybody who sees that physician, the idea would potentially be to standardize in that way. But there are many, many other ways, and the standardization is so critical. So we only have a couple minutes left, and I was going to ask a question about funding and then a question about challenges, but I imagine those two things might go together. So I wonder if I could just turn to each of you and sort of in the way that we're going to be working together in the future. Obviously we have a number of ideas for strategic solutions to help you all, to help the physicians that are in the diagnosis and in the treatment space and institutions that we want to try to work on together. And Stan will talk about some of those others later today. But I wonder if each of you could kind of just comment a little bit on kind of what are the key challenges that you hope that we can tackle together here in the short term. Now, Liz, we'll start with you.
Okay. So the institutions are not a small barrier. You basically have to really push your institution into doing this because they don't want to because they think it's going to cost them money. So if you can convince them it's not going to cost them money, then sometimes you can go forward, and that's basically what I've had to do. So I've had a few kind of novel solutions to some of it. We've recently actually created an N of One fund in philanthropy for philanthropy to work on finding donors that want to give money to Rush to potentially support this exciting treatment of individual patients with personalized medicine. So that's one of the solutions we've had to the institutional issues. I think one of our big challenges in the field, of course, because I'm in neurology, is outcome measures, which is a challenge for everybody in neurology. And I think that I was the originator of the closet idea. And I think what we need is to add all this work together, share it among other groups like N1C and like Combined Brain, which wants to develop to do outcome measure standardization as well, and get outcome measures for each type of thing like cognitive or motor function, and for each severity, because you would use different measures for someone mild, moderate, or severe. Validate those. Get those, sort of that you have them on the shelf, and people can come in. Well, I have a patient like this, and so these are things that I could potentially consider using.
Yeah, that's great. And Liz has been a very, I think you've been a great mentor also for other physicians have often learned a lot from your experience. Sesh, what about you?
So not being a neurologist, because I wasn't smart enough, I wasn't smart enough to be a neurologist, I take care of babies. And the biggest problem for babies is breathing. And misspelling in various, rare misspellings in various genes disrupt the lung transition from womb to world. And some of these rare misspellings result in irreversible and progressive lung failure, which currently is only addressable with lung transplantation. So we transplant half dozen babies a year with these genetic misspellings for whom nothing else is available. And I am hopeful, thanks to Stan's support, that we are going to make some progress on ASO development for helping these babies to breathe without transplanting their lungs.
That's amazing. Yeah, thank you for that. Olivia?
I think, you know, in terms of challenges, there's very many bringing an ASO forward in an institution. I mean, funding, regulatory, lots of different aspects that need to move in parallel to really deliver it at the same time. And that's why the funding mechanisms, like Liz said, with philanthropy is very important, outside of grants and things like that as well. And then the institutional buy-in, I mean, it's a different model from regular clinical trials, even if it was for rare disease clinical trials. And so that takes a lot of effort in explaining that and then changing the regulatory model and even IRB processes. And so that takes time. I think it's going to be an issue across all institutions, and that's why it's important to partner with other groups like N1C or NLORM in bringing these things together so that we reduce redundancy and effort and just kind of streamline things for everybody to move things forward.
Well, the first time will always be the hardest, right? So it will never be this hard again for you.
Okay,
let's hope, right? Neil, how about you?
Well, I think many of the challenges have been mentioned. I would say one of the greatest areas of challenge is going to come from our success. As these things start working, I think we're going to be seeing more and more cases, and dealing with that volume is going to be tricky. And in the case of neurodegenerative diseases, and this may be a little bit different from some of the developmental disorders, we have the ability to identify and track individuals in advance of symptom onset, and I think that we will have challenges related to the implementation of these therapeutics earlier in patients' course, and ideally even before disease onset, and dealing with the regulatory and logistical challenges of that, I think, is a happy challenge.
Well, that's a great way to end the conversation. And just thank you so much. I'd like to thank all our panelists for being here today. Appreciate you guys.
NLORM is a nonprofit committed to discovering and providing personalized experimental treatments for free, for life, to patients with genetic diseases that affect 1 to 30 patients worldwide, referred to by NLORM as nano-rare. Many of these patients progress and die without ever achieving a diagnosis. This is where NLORM comes in. They do the impossible by providing hope, and for those that they can help, free lifetime treatment. For more information about NLORM or today's episode, visit nlorm.org. Any questions can be sent into podcast@nlorm.org. Search NLORM on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook to connect with us. This video is hosted by Dr. Stan Crook and produced with the help of the following professionals. Thank you for watching.